Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the journey of self-leadership mastery and life success. Reinvent or evolve yourself as you redesign your business. Dual innovation. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and more effectively. Learn something new from our conversation today.
Nancy, this experience has been both humbling and joyful for me. The ability to talk about these things with someone else and know that this message and what you're doing gets shared with these broader communities. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to participate in this and know that what I might know or might experience could help others. It's really humbling. So thank you for the opportunity.
Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. This year, I'm focused on a variety of conversations. Many of them are going to be about cultural competency. A noticeable aspect of being culturally competent, especially during this COVID pandemic, is being aware of others' mental health and making sure we are taking care of ourselves. Our well-being and mental health are being tested as we get our footing in the beginnings of a third year of the coronavirus pandemic and its Delta and Omicron variants, and who knows what else is coming down the pipeline for us. But we are equipping ourselves psychologically, and we want to give you the tools to really help you psychologically process what's going on and emotionally kind of work within yourself to identify what you're experiencing as you're going through this. So today's guest mentor, I'm so excited, is Leah Seeger, a marriage and family therapist in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We would like to fortify you with six psychological and overlapping therapeutic themes that you can use to navigate with your family and staff this year. These themes come from anecdotal evidence, some research we've been doing, and stories that have surfaced since the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. Hi, Leah. How are you today?
Good. How are you, Nancy?
I'm trying to stay warm. We made a family trip to San Diego where it was in the 60s, kind of 70 degrees, beautiful, sunny. And then we got back from San Diego and jumped right into the frigid cold weather here in Minnesota. But it really, you know, wakes you up and makes you feel vibrant.
It does. I personally enjoy it for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, it's always good to have activities that you can do too. I found like walking now is just wonderful. As long as I'm dressed warm enough, I seem to be able to handle it. But as soon as I'm, you know, not dressed, like when you go to meetings and things, now that we're out and about a little bit more, I typically don't always dress warm enough. And so it feels really cold. But when I dress warm enough, I just feel and my torso's warm. I just feel like it's more bearable.
Yep. Having the gear for the environment is super helpful.
Yeah. Well, let me give our audience a little bit more background about you, Leah. Leah Seeger is a therapist, writer, educator, and activist in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Leah specializes in supporting people struggling with trauma, grief, addiction, and other challenges impacting their relationships and mental health. In her therapy practice at Lynn Lake Centers for Well-Being, Leah works with individuals, couples, and families. Leah describes herself as a systemic relational therapist who brings compassion, curiosity, and humor to the therapeutic process. She helps clients navigate the challenges that cultural norms, systemic issues, historical pressures, and personal values have on individuals or their relationships. As a transplant to Minnesota, a former advertising executive, a trauma survivor, and a self-identified creative weirdo, Leah attempts to utilize her wealth of experiences in the lifelong work of empathizing with, understanding, and supporting people. So Leah currently serves on the Board of Minnesota Association for Marriage and Family Therapy as the External Affairs Chair. She was an adjunct professor in the Addiction Studies Graduate Program at St. Mary's University of Minnesota. When not supporting others, Leah can be found reading, hiking, doing yoga, playing volleyball, or connecting with her favorite people over music, good food, and laughter. And you also just shared with me off the mic, Leah, that in your former life, you were a guitarist in a band.
Not a guitarist. I'm a lead singer.
You were the lead singer.
One of the lead singers, yes.
Fantastic. What kind of music?
So it's a silly little cover band. Myself and another therapist friend of mine are both singers, and she is married to a phenomenal guitarist. And we put together a little group where we sing songs that are related to therapy, honestly. Oh. And then one person will be singing and the other person will therapize while the other person is singing. So it's kind of like a gag, making fun a little bit of therapy and enjoying the process of singing and being in community with other therapists and healthcare professionals.
Oh, wow. Are you still doing some of that?
The hope is to continue to do that, but it has been very hard to do that in a pandemic when we have lots of healthcare professionals, in addition to immune-compromised people who are members of the band. So we've not been active recently, but the hope is to get back into the studio and practice again and connect together that way too.
Nice. Well, you and I first met after I read an article in the New York Times on January 3rd. It's entitled, "We Surveyed 1,320 Therapists Across the Nation. They're Worried About Mental Health in the United States." And I noticed a statement that you made in the article, and it really stuck with me. And then I looked you up and I noticed that you were in Minneapolis. And I thought, oh, I'm going to give you a call and set up a meeting. The comment that stuck with me and still does is in quotations, you said, "I believe I will be helping people navigate the effects of the pandemic for the rest of my career," end quote. And what struck me is when we met in person, you're in your mid-40s.
Early 40s, actually. So yeah, I've got a good 30 years, I expect, to continue to be doing this.
Yeah, so that is, wow. I was shocked by that, but I can see, like we had talked about, you know, there's some aspects of 9/11 that we're still experiencing, and people who lost, you know, loved ones still grieve the loss there. Yeah, so I can see where you're coming from. So I really enjoyed our meeting in person, and you and I were just having so much fun just, you know, trying to figure out, because there's so many different ways in which we could be talking about different aspects of what we're experiencing from a psychological and human perspective. And together we thought, let's take a look at some 6 psychological and overlapping kind of therapeutic themes that we're noticing of the coronavirus pandemic. But before we kind of dig a little deeper into that, could you let us know a little bit about yourself? Like, what was it growing up in your home?
Absolutely. So the best way to describe my experience growing up would be complicated, right? Like, I think most families are complicated. And mine was no different. I grew up with a art teacher mother and a salesman father, middle-class family in a very small town in southwestern Michigan. And like lots of challenges that our family faced growing up. My father was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease when I was a teenager.
Wow.
My family has a lot of historical struggles with addiction issues and unaddressed mental health issues, a lot of family conflict, in addition to having a household that was also very warm and welcoming of people. And my family was one that loved to entertain and make people laugh and connect together. There's this dichotomy of big problems, but also big love and joy. So that's kind of the long and short of what I grew up with.
Sure. Who else was in your home? Did you have some siblings?
Yes, I do. I have a younger brother who is 4 years younger than me. And a lot of people who, like, my family was one that we always had what I call today is family, right? Like friends that equate to family. It was very true because we didn't live near biological family for most of my life. And like my dad's best friend was like an uncle to me, and my dad's best friend's mom kind of served as a substitute grandmother for me. And those people were a big part of my life. In my growing up as well, just as much as the, you know, four of us in our home. And then, of course, the dogs, because that's family too in my household.
Did you have more than one dog?
We only had one at a time at any point, but there was always a dog in the house, always a dog.
And what would you say are 4 to 6 words that would describe each of your parents?
So when we talk about complicated, right, like I want to talk about the good and the helpful and also the hard and the challenging. So yeah. Be honest about that with my parents, too. So if I were to think about my father, I would say that he was very charismatic, but in a funny, silly kind of way. He was very smart. He was also very proud, and he was also kind of stubborn at times, and sometimes proud and stubborn when you put them together can look like selfishness. That's how I conceptualize that now looking back on it.
Yeah.
And I guess I would describe my mom as creative. She's a high school art teacher, and she was very energetic. She's very warm. She's also a little bit gullible and also kind of stubborn. Those are probably some really good descriptors that consider the things that I found really beautiful and helpful, and also the things that led to some challenges.
Yeah. And how did your family address some of those life-changing challenges?
I think there was always a response of love, right? And a desire for connectedness and a commitment to making sure that the basic needs were met in my family.
Okay.
However, family really struggled with talking about like life-changing challenges. And very frequently in my family, we didn't talk about the hard things until they were like blowing up in your face. So that's a thing that I swung the other end of the pendulum there and became a therapist, where I talk about hard things all day, every day, and love it.
From what you experienced in your own family, you grew a desire to really talk about hard things.
Yep.
Yeah. And so now you just dive right in.
Yeah. I tell people all the time, I talk about hard things for a living, and I really appreciate that. I love the openness and the honesty and the care that gets to come from like not shoving those hard things aside and talking about them openly, respectfully. Obviously, as a therapist, we have to like honor where a client is at, but being able to talk about those things and then choosing people in my life today with whom I can, right, like very openly and honestly talk about hard things, right? Like the people who are closest to me today are people with whom I can have those types of conversations that maybe I didn't get enough opportunity to do so in my childhood.
Yeah. Well, what were some of your childhood interests?
Oh, I was a theater kid. I was, right, any opportunity to be on stage, I loved. I was also a pretty outdoorsy kid. It was a kind of cool combination, right? Like I could go for long walks, and we could, right, rollerblade and sled and hike and play in creeks and get all muddy. I was more of the explorer kid, the theater kid, and also kind of ran a little bit of a nerdy kid. I, to this day, can get very lost in books. Like bookshelves in any house that I will own will always be like stacked full of options. So that's kind of the long and short of what I loved as a little person.
And when did you find yourself beginning to be assertive or asserting self-leadership, where you're kind of taking charge of your destiny and your personal growth and development?
Sure. That absolutely started in high school for me, maybe middle school even. But right, like as much as there's so many benefits to growing up in a small place in the world, I never felt like I fit in that environment. And so, right, like when middle school and high school came around, and that's usually a very important time in a person's life in which they figure out, oh, who am I and where do I fit? I kind of never felt like I fit. I was the person who always strove to use the skills that I had to create opportunities for myself. So I was, right, like nerdy kids, straight A student, salutatorian of the class. I was always working hard at something. I've never been someone who's been good at being idle. So got involved in everything I could get involved in with the hope of I really want to go to college and I really want to have an opportunity to find places in which I might be able to fit, because I never fully felt that way in my youth and adolescence. And maybe that's partially the environment that I was in. Maybe that's partially the home that I was in, the community that I was in. That's where it's interesting to think of myself now as a systemic therapist and able to look back and see like, oh, this is why that didn't fit. Here's why that didn't fit. And I was able to make good on all of that, thankfully, right? Partially due to a lot of support and a fair amount of privilege, but also through a lot of good work ethic.
Yeah. The combination worked well. Where did you go to college at and what did you major in?
So my undergraduate degree is in business administration. I focused on advertising and consumer behavior at The Ohio State University. So I went from a small town high school graduating class of 42 people to the second largest undergraduate program in the country.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Big adjustment.
I jumped into the big old pond. The first lecture hall I went to was bigger than my entire high school.
Yeah. And you must have found your way somehow and your group of people.
Yeah, no, I found my people, whether it was my roommates. I belonged to a sorority in my undergraduate program, which I met a number of, right, some of my greatest friends still to this day, like the ability to volunteer. I continued to work during that time. So like a lot of opportunities to really find where I fit and had a great ability to do that while I was in my undergraduate program.
Did you have a chance to, or did you, to work before you went on to your master's degree?
Yep. So I actually spent about 12 years as an advertising executive before I became what's known as a second career therapist.
I love that. So second career therapist. Yes.
Yeah. I worked in small full service ad agencies for my first 7 years out of my undergraduate program. And that was during a really hard time. That's when the housing bubble bust, Great Recession occurred during that time frame. It's a hard time to be a young ad exec for a multitude of reasons. My own personal struggles. But then when I moved here to Minneapolis, I worked for a subdivision of a really large media planning agency, a worldwide company. So done a lot of work in the ad world and the media planning world.
Okay. And what made you decide to switch and become a therapist?
Well, at the time, my family was going through some really significant hardships. My father was at the lowest point in his struggle with Parkinson's disease. I was also having my own personal, right, like response to that. My parents were going through a divorce. It was, right, like I was in the process of formalizing my relationship with my then partner, now spouse. And so I was in therapy and really taking a good look at my life and what I wanted for myself and I was looking at what happened at the next levels of the agency world. And I was watching my boss take her laptop to her kid's soccer game. And I was watching my boss's boss leave, you know, her family vacations early to go on business pitches. And I was grinding it out, doing really well by my clients, I would say. But at the same time, right, like it didn't matter what I did if other people struggled in the agency, or I could bring in millions of dollars of business, but I might not get a bonus depending upon what other people did. So I looked at all of those variables together and said, I can't do this for the next 30 plus years of my life. Yeah. And strangely enough, my therapist at the time was also a person who was a second career therapist, had left corporate America to become a therapist. And I was like, well, this is a way I can do this. This is a way I can take my creativity and my communication skills and my passion for people and systemic thinking. I can take that in this realm and I get to do that just for me and the person in the room, not for this bigger entity. And that felt like a really good fit for for me. So I was in my very early 30s when I decided to leave corporate America and start grad school and become a therapist.
Oh, and you've got a number of different designations behind your name. So yep. MA stands for Master in Arts. What's the LMFT?
So that's a licensed marriage and family therapist. That is my mental health professional license, my primary mental health professional license. That means my focus, the training that I have with regards to psychology is systemic in nature. I think about the person, not just as an individual, but who they are and in relationship to others, and how both those relationships and the world around them can affect them and vice versa. And so that's part of how we're trained as licensed marriage and family therapists, is to really think about things systemically. More frequently, you know, in addition to individual counselors, we're often working with couples and families. And so that's what the LMFT does.
And the LADC?
That's a licensed alcohol and drug counselor. I started my career as a therapist working in alcohol and drug treatment facilities, and I wanted to have that licensure, that knowledge, to be able to support people who were struggling with addiction or whose family members struggled with substance use or process addictions, in addition to, right, like not just working with the couple unit, but like very frequently. Right? Addiction affects more than just the individual, and I wanted the ability to serve both simultaneously.
Mm. Yeah. It's a great combo, especially because it's systemic, right? It's a system in how people are relating with each other. And yeah. In the article that I read, the New York Times reporters surveyed 1,320 therapists. And you were one of those that filled out the survey. And in the article, they mentioned that like more than 9,000 people signed a petition asking for mental health services at St. Louis University. And over the past decade, they're seeing that the rate of depression, anxiety, and serious thoughts of suicide has doubled among college students. And the pandemic has really intensified the trends where students report lower levels of psychological well-being, according to Daniel Eisenberg, a professor at UCLA. And the Healthy Minds study also that he was quoting from also reported higher levels of resiliency. So people meeting needs of safety, satisfaction, and connection. I was curious to know, what has been your experience regarding clients coming in with depression, anxiety, and other mental health challenges? Are these issues on the rise since the COVID pandemic, since you've been at the Lynn Lake Centers for Well-Being?
I believe that these have been on the rise for some time now, or in my personal opinion, right? Like I would say that the factors that create the circumstances in which people experience depression and anxiety, right? Like they've become more prevalent and they've become more seen. I like to think that the pandemic very likely pushed a lot of people over the edge or took away some of the things that allow for resiliency, right? Like lack of safety, lack of connection, lack of satisfaction in things, another series of burdens to bear might be the straw that broke the collective camel's back when it comes to a lot of people's mental health struggles.
Yeah. And so as a result of these things, your practice has changed, and we'll talk about that in a couple minutes. But I wanted to talk about the first two themes that you and I were kind of brainstorming about of the six psychological and overlapping therapeutic themes that we noticed during this pandemic. We also say that it's overlapping because it's not just moving from, it's not a stage. So we're not moving from one thing to another. With a theme, you kind of expand, and there's all these nuances that are occurring at the same time and maybe overlapping. So in theme one, panic and anxiety accompanies news of a novel virus, which was disclosed mid-March of 2020. So at that time, lots of things were happening, like stockpiling of toilet paper and certain other amenities. Store shelves were becoming bare in certain areas. Inconsistent information began between the medical science of the CDC and other agencies and the leadership in the country. And we all thought that this would be, you know, initially a few months and we'd be back to everyday living. You work with a systems perspective in therapy based on Bronfenbrenner's. Is that correct?
Bronfenbrenner's ecological systems theory model.
Yeah, which he developed in 1974. Can you tell us briefly? So there's five different elements of this system, because I think that they're really helpful to understand, and it shows kind of how we're all connected.
Systems theory, right? Like Bronfenbrenner's is a very specific, right, detailed systems theory. And I work from a general systems theory in addition to appreciating a lot about Bronfenbrenner's ecological systems theory model. And all right, like I know that you'll likely have the imagery on this, but I want you to imagine that each person is at the center of a bullseye in their lives, right? Like they are the center. And the idea of these systems models is that we are influenced by and we have the potential to influence up and down that bullseye. So if the person is at the center of their own bullseye, right? Like then the immediate communities around them, right, known as the microsystem, have a big impact on that person, right? Like their family and the school that they went to and the peers in their lives and, right, like whatever other service or support organizations that are around them, whether that is, right, like a family community or a religious community or, right, like other important influences, right? Like that's the next layer of the bullseye. Mm. And that obviously has a huge impact on the person, right? Like we are influenced by the people around us. We are shaped by, right, like those influences, right? Like how many people show up in my therapy room and say like, well, my mom always used to say this and I used to hate hearing it, but like now I find myself believing it and saying that same thing to my kid.
Yeah, right. Or I've heard the term, the older I get, the more I'm like my mother.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So the idea that like we can't not be influenced by those things. But like the idea that those families, those people were influenced by things too, right? They were influenced by different things in their lives, their jobs, their right, like what leadership was doing in their community at that period of time, the media that they were, right, exposed to, their economic situation, right? Like if you talk about, right, like that next layer, that next ring in a person's life, the idea that like, well, like if your parents, if you're like me and you grew up middle class, right, like you have a different experience than maybe a person who grows up affluent or a person who grows up below the poverty line. They're going to have access to different things, and that has significant influence on a person's life, right? Like I had access to, right, like different things because of my social economic status than someone else. I was raised in a rural community, right? Like that has an influence and it's different than a person who's raised, right, in an urban environment. And so like, again, you keep going these levels up, right? Like the next system level is, right, like what's happening in the culture, what's happening in the world at that time, right? Like the idea that like you think about the things that have changed culturally since I was an adolescent, right? Like when I was growing up, the internet was barely a thing, right? Cell phones didn't exist until I was a late teenager, right? Smartphones didn't exist until I was in my mid-20s. And, you know, right now I can, right, like hang out with my favorite 5-year-old and they know how to use an iPad better than I do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right.
That has an influence. That shifts that individual's way of thinking. In addition to like how cultural values change over time or shift over time, right? Like I was looking up like the idea that like when I was a teenager, right? Like I remember when Ellen came out, right?
The talk show. Oh, no, when she came out on her TV show.
Yeah, when she, right, yeah. Like she's the first central character to be openly gay, right, on a television show. That was like, right, like groundbreaking. And now here we are in 2020. too. And like, there are lots of central characters that are members of the LGBTQ community. We have entire TV shows, entire networks, right? Like, yeah. Designed to, right? Like, display and show those lives in ways that weren't even shown 30 years ago. So like, that's that next level system layer of like influence on a person.
And if we put names to these, not to get bogged down in the linguistics, but I'll include the image and the resource. And so, Leah, you've been talking like we started out with the microsystem and
correct.
Then the mesosystem. What is the mesosystem? Exosystems, that's the extended family and the neighbors and the being on the school board, or we're influenced by policies when our kids go to school or when we went to school, the government agencies are influencing us, social services and mass media and parents' mm-hmm. economic situation, like you were talking about. What is the meso that's between the micro and the exo?
And there's a reason why, like, I will be honest with you, I don't have like a real clear definition for that.
Okay.
Right. The idea that like there's a gray area there, right? Like the idea that, again, this is not a, well, here's where this lives and here's where this lives and here's where this lives, right? There's a back and forth between the, right? A gray area between the exosystem and the microsystem, because if you think about like, okay, well, school versus school board. Well, my mom was part of the school. She was a teacher, right? So she was in both areas and she's impacted in both ways. So I don't have a great way to describe that well. Because it
represents kind of the merging of actually the micro and the exo, where you're going outward, right? And then when you get to the macro level, you're kind of the attitudes and the ideologies of the culture, like you were mm-hmm. talking about, are really starting to influence us. And what struck me when I looked at this and read a little bit more about it in preparation, the chronosystem, the environmental changes that occur over the life course, it's a very outside layer. And so I was thinking maybe that's why it takes longer for us to understand the environmental impact.
Correct. Because it's not something you can just put your finger on, right? Like the idea that like things that occur over the course of a lifetime, right? Like sometimes we don't see until we have the capacity to look back on them and see how they've influenced and changed over the course of a lifetime, right? Like we have the ability to look backwards at our macro systems and our chronosystems, where we, right? Like we're living in our microsystems, we're living in our exosystems.
So introducing the ecological systems by Bronfenbrenner's research, we get a visual and we get also some dialogue between us communicating about it, that there are many different things that occurred when the virus kind of was hitting us and making adjustments. And that brings us to the second theme, which social distancing kind of moved in and other life-altering changes, like we became more virtual living. We became more focused on virtual living, like ordering more things online, like Amazon just exploded. You know, and we had changes. There's lots of changes coming at us really fast. And there were stickers all of a sudden at the grocery stores, plastic partitions, you know, when we checked out, which are still there. We experienced the lack of physical touch and getting gatherings were no longer okay. And there was a social justice uprising with the killing of George Floyd, who was murdered. And, you know, the outrage, you know, that affected us globally.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time that I felt really scared in my Golden Valley home.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever remember being more the sheer terror. And all of us in the metro were just hypersensitive to that.
Yeah. Well, and we had good reason to be, right, like hypersensitive to that, because we were grappling with, right, like that this horrific thing had happened, and George Floyd's murder, that is, right? And the anger that was a natural response to that being so visible. But then at the same time, we are living with like a sense of lack of safety or security in our immediate system, right? Like we have people living in communities where they have smoke, right? Like from the fires that were happening and as a result of the uprising. We had people who had Black Hawk helicopters flying over their homes. We had people marching down the streets. We had just this lack of security that very few people who are from the United States have ever really experienced.
Yeah, and boarded up buildings. So my daughter Olivia and I talked with her prior to our conversations about what her experience was her freshman year at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we were struck by all the buildings and they were all boarded up. Mm-hmm. And even locally here, we were experiencing kind of the same thing. And it was showing up across all the major cities across the country.
Mm-hmm. Because, and the sad part of that is the focus was on how do we protect the property, right? Which, again, I care about, right? Like, these are people's homes, these are people's businesses, right? But a thing I've struggled with the both and-ness of is, like, I care about those properties, I care about those businesses, but I care about the life that was lost and the meaning that that displayed to people about how, right, like people of color and especially African-American people, Black people, don't have a sense of safety, right, in their own bodies, in their own going to the store, right? Like that, those two things were happening simultaneously, right? And we didn't know how to, right? Like our own personal physical safety, right? I'm a white person and what it feels like to feel unsafe in my community. And then also trying to figure out like, how do I stay present to the empathy necessary for, wow, a person of color goes through that lack of safety walking through the world.
I was freaking out in that moment. And then I was thinking about my Black friends and communities and thinking that they're having that experience, you know, all the time.
Yeah, that lack of safety. And that's where George Floyd's murder ignited a series of awareness as well as a series of rage, right? An understandable rage, right?
Yeah.
At seeing this and honestly seeing this in a way that was really visceral, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, yeah, the video that the young woman captured of George Floyd's murder, right, and the callousness that was displayed is an understandable. It's a place where it's understandable that a person would respond with grief and rage.
Yeah, and the experience of those who were in the vicinity of that, or the clerk who reported George Floyd, guilt that he was feeling. There was just like so many different layers and stories of suffering and social injustices that we were just, it was compiling on top of people we know were dying or, you know, hospitals filling up. And the degree of feeling out of control and being threatened bumped us out of our ability to feel like we have some stability.
Yes.
So how are you noticing that people are gaining control and direction and their footing? I know at that time, we weren't. We were just...
How could we, right? Like, we were still in the middle of something that was very traumatic. And so the idea that, like, when you are in the middle of something that is very traumatic, it is very hard to, right, like, gain or maintain a sense of direction or grounding. It's when we're triggered by fear, it is so easy for our brains to go into, well, how do I protect myself? How do I, right? How do I keep myself and my, right? Like we go back down to that micro system and go, how do I keep the people in this family safe? Right?
Yeah.
And that's what happened during this time, right? Like the idea that like the pandemic, in addition to what happened here in our city and as a response to George Floyd's murder, right? Like there are two different layers right on top of each other of like really destabilizing emotions for a lot of people. I don't know whether I can go hug my friend or my niece, right? And I also am feeling fear with all of the, right, like uprising and anger that is being experienced and the damage to property that is happening as a result of that anger. That's a lot of lack of stability people have we're going through it all at the same time. And so like finding a way to go, okay, well, what is within my control? What is the thing that I can do for myself, for my family, and determine, do I have bandwidth to then give to something else, something beyond myself, is something a lot of people were grappling with at that time, myself included, to be quite honestly.
Yeah. Well, tell me more. How did you navigate with the intensity? And tell us a little bit about how your practice, how you were adjusting with changing your practice to a virtual therapy sessions.
So yeah, during that time, I was quite literally, right, like doing therapy in the basement of my home virtually, because we were still, right, like unsure of how to keep ourselves safe from the virus. And so the best way that I could do that is to stay home and work virtually, and know that my role at that time was like, okay, how do I do everything that I can do to stay grounded, to support the people in my life, and then maintain that grounding through, and like my versions of that were yoga and meditation and, right, like regular connection with the people who are my friends and family, and then be able to go like, okay, and the thing that I get to give back is I get to hold space for, right, others who are processing the lack of safety or the distress of this. Mm. And so, like, knowing that my job some days was to just listen and hold the fear of others or the rage of others, like especially any BIPOC clients that I had, it was definitely my space to sit down, shut up, and listen to them and hold that and just be able to go like, yeah, you have every right to that pain, that anger, that rage.
Yeah.
I see, care about that, right? And not try to soothe that, because it needed to burn. It deserved to burn.
Yeah.
And to, you know.
And when you're referring to BIPOC, you're referring to the Black Indigenous people of color.
Yes, I am referring to people who do not identify with a white body, are not white-bodied individuals.
And how did other therapists as a collective group at Lynn Lake Centers for Wellbeing, how did you all sort this through professionally?
Well, I think this is hard to say, because like my group is a very large one, right? Like there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 or 160 plus therapists at Lynn Lake Centers for Wellbeing. And so I have a smaller group within that large group that I am part of a consult group with. We were talking regularly with each other. We were talking about how to support each other. We were, you know, making room for the therapists to have space to rage or cry or support each other as we watched these things and determine, like, where did we want to contribute to supporting neighborhoods or supporting individuals in response to this, right? Like, whether it be donating to causes. There were people who participated in the cleanup efforts in some of the more damaged cities, right? Like, I know people who are artists who, right, like did the work of painting on those boarded up buildings so that we had a sense of beauty to and support and community in response to all of that. So everybody's way of responding is different, and everybody's way of supporting each other looks different. Some people were out in the streets marching and supporting, right, like efforts for change, and other people were holding, right, space in community and small groups. Other people were determining, how can we show up and be of support versus where do we need to sit down and just listen?
Yeah, exactly. And is there anything else that you would like to add about what you've learned about the human spirit and about how people have been adjusting to this significant aspect of change as you're reflecting on this aspect of our lives?
Yeah, like a thing that I have learned about myself is how important it is to acknowledge when I'm not feeling grounded, to know when I'm not feeling rooted, and be careful about how I respond in that time frame, being really intentional about like, oh, what's happening in my body right now, right? And what do I need to do to reground myself so that I can show up for these people, these causes that are important to me? And to know that while some of the important variables of what I had previously done in the past were not accessible to me, right? Like I couldn't go to the yoga studio. I couldn't, right, like sit down and have dinner with my beloved people like I would normally do I couldn't go play volleyball at the end of the day. Like, and so to know that, like, what else do I need when I'm feeling ungrounded, right? Because change is not something that we do well when it happens quickly. Our bodies take time to adjust to change, and we didn't have time to adjust, right? The pandemic hit so fast.
Yeah.
Lockdowns happened so fast. Like, all of the layered things that were happening, all these big changes that were happening at once, were really hard on people's bodies, and both removed access to some of their prior grounding mechanisms and had to do the work of going, okay, what else could we substitute this with, or what else will support us in feeling and allowing ourselves to get regrounded, knowing that's not going to be perfect, right? Like, it's different to see my best friend via Zoom on Friday night versus having her sitting on the couch with me and being able to give her a hug, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been through that part. We've been experiencing these themes. We're going to move into, in our next conversation, about theme three, this systemic strain in disruption of well-being, and some of the longer-term effects that we need to navigate as we're moving through this. And so I'm hoping in our conversation as a listener that you've been able to just take a step back and reflect on your own experience as we just discuss, a little bit more and name the themes that we've been experiencing, the panic and the anxiety that was accompanying something we've never experienced before, a pandemic. The last one was in 1918, and so no one's alive to give us information about that. And unless we do a lot of reading, which I've been doing lately to help with understanding all the different variants that are coming about, that's not totally uncommon. And then theme two, we've been just talking about social distancing and other ways that our life had changed during that time and how Leah has navigated through it and kind of what she was experiencing in helping other people and holding space for the degree and volume of anger and fear and uncertainty as we went through this. Is there anything else that you'd like to add in this conversation, Leah?
Yeah, just a recognition that a lot changed really fast for people, and we had to adapt to a lot of things really quickly. And just to give people an awareness that adapting really quickly is hard on our bodies and hard on our mental health. And so if a person is experiencing distress as a response to those fast changes, that makes sense. That's natural.
Yeah.
That would be hard for you, or that might be hard for your family, or that might be hard for your community, right? Like, this idea that we need to adapt really quick is just not a realistic one, and yet one that we are often forced to have to do very frequently, especially in the past 2 years.
Yeah.
So self-forgiveness for this distress can be taking on your body and on your heart and on your mind.
Yeah, not forcing ourselves to push through, that we've really needed to take time to kind of grapple with what we're experiencing and noticing how others are going through similar things, but it may be showing up differently for them.
Yeah, everybody's responding to those changes differently, and like having some compassion and grace for ourselves and for others as we all navigate this differently, as we all adapt differently to such rapid change.
Oh, well, thank you for this wonderful conversation. I just really appreciate the context and the way in which you are able to help us navigate these first two of six psychological and overlapping therapeutic themes that we're experiencing that are very unique to our lives right now.
Thank you for the opportunity to share it with others.
Excellent. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in and just acknowledging what you've been going through, and use the themes to kind of understand what others are going through in your life, and also how you can help continue to lead your way through this with your staff and others that you work with. And Mike Cabea, sound engineer, videographer, photographer, mon frère de notre mère, brother from another mother. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
See you next week. you want to build upon your leadership skills and become effective as a business owner? Do you want to evolve yourself as you redesign your business? You can. We know that dual innovation with mentoring works. We've mentored thousands of emerging to experienced entrepreneurial leaders and small business owners in this dual innovation process since 1992. We are here to co-create a mentoring process where you can nourish resilient relationships while you redesign your business. Resilient relationships promote relational literacy, the ability to understand and express healthy ways of relating. Even a slight increase in relational literacy can lead to significant improvement in all of your relationships. So why not take the risk to move out of dysfunctional relating and move into ways to deepen your connection to yourself and others? Assert self-leadership. If you aren't already subscribed to this podcast, go do it now. Go to wementor.com and get the support and skills needed to build a purposeful life journey with your peers on the entrepreneurial leadership path, consciously co-creating our future. You can also join our virtual mentoring community for one-on-one strategic mentoring or participate in a WeMentor lab, because we mentor meaningful conversations and activities that lead to higher levels of functionality and engagement in our world and everything that we do with each other. So engage your curiosity and become the leader you envision yourself to be today. WeMentor.com. Go there. Check it out.